Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Angela Alberti.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. I am your podcast host for today's episode, Angela Alberti. Absolutely thrilled that you guys are able to sit with us and join us on some exciting conversation. Super thrilled to be interviewing today Donna Hamlin. Donna is a, based on the West Coast and is going to be giving us an introduction on what she specializes in. Before we hand it over to Donna, I just want to give everyone a quick reminder to have a moment and give us a rating in the App Store. When you give us the stars and the thumbs up and the reviews, it helps us get in front of more listeners like yourself. So without any further ado, Donna, please introduce yourself.
Well, thanks for the invitation to be part of this. Yeah, my background is a little bit in evolution always, I would say. Right. I started out in strategic planning, working at headquarters at General Electric many years ago. And I was involved with making big decisions on where investments would go into the particular business units. The more I looked at what looked brilliant on paper as a strategy, I would notice that certain ones bombed in execution, and I got interested in why. The more I looked at that, the more I realized that it had to do with either talent decisions, leadership issues, something related to human capital.
Wow.
And I thought, gee, if I could shift my thinking from pure strategy to the precursor variable called human capital, we might have better success rates. Mm-hmm. So I have moved my work now much more into the responsibilities that are underneath that umbrella, as well as what it means for thinking about that long term from a board level.
Wow, that's super fantastic. Thank you for that overview. You know, I was just on LinkedIn. Well, I'm on LinkedIn every day, but yesterday I happened to read across a study. And it was of a lady who mentioned that at one point she thought she was going to be at this company for her entire career. As soon as the leader that she had looked up to and admired, who really helped pave the way for her in her career, left, she realized that she was in a completely different company and decided to walk away. And I think that that really resonates with what you're speaking on, is everything looks wonderful on paper, but truly, is that going to mesh well with the dynamics behind human capital? So super excited to get into that. Can you tell us a little bit more about the company that you founded, how long you've been around, and the type of clients that you guys work with?
Well, we have two companies. We started a management consulting company in 1982, so it will be 40 years old in April next year. I'm going to start counting backwards now. But about 12 years ago, a number of our clients started complaining about issues related to corporate governance. And we looked at that and said, gee, this needs special attention. So we have now a separate entity called Boardwise that takes a look at all issues related to board corporate governance. And we fortunately had enough work in 48 countries with our management consulting that it was easy for us to then go into those environments and take a look at corporate governance and say, gee, we can add this to what we're offering. And so we don't compete with whatever is sitting around endemically in an area like the National Associations of Corporate Directors. We just sit sidecar to that and say, we'll add the global piece.
Wow.
Because nothing sits above the nation state to adjudicate matters of governance when it's different country to country. There's no right answer. Mm-hmm. So you have to put your wisdom around, if you're working in a business that has footprints in multiple countries, you have to figure out what's your standard when it's different rules in different places.
Yeah, different rules, different places, different cultural impact, different everything from everything across the board. So let's get into that. Let's think about this at the fundamental level. Somebody from the outside, myself included, let's talk about how the vitality of the board and what they do and how that really truly lends to proper corporate governance.
Yeah, I think you have to go backwards to think about that for the future, because
right.
there was a time when there wasn't really much in the way of governance at all. It was just a need that there needs to be check and balance between the belief that a leader, a CEO, should be the priest and decide things, as opposed to having wisdom around the table that balances mm-hmm. that out. As corporate governance moved forward, it was more about protecting the shareholders. Now, time has gone by and it's become much more complicated and much more accountable for the long-term value of an enterprise going forward. And if you study what's happening with governance and what boards are responsible for, I'd say that European initiatives, maybe 14 years ago or so, started pushing what I call governance 2.0, which means that they were saying, no, we are responsible for the planet, the climate, the people, you wow. name it. They were taking the entire environment
wow.
under responsible parties to say, if we're going to have a business that's going to live, we need to create an environment that will allow it to. Now, when I would talk to directors here in the United States, they'd say, they're crazy over there. That's not right. We should just take care of our shareholders. Well, that's changed. And, mm-hmm. you know, I saw it coming then, and now you're starting to see all these new regulatory practices that are issued out of the stock exchange that says, no, you now have to file reports in your K reports about environmental responsibilities, social responsibilities, good governance practices. Those all now have to be published. Mm-hmm. Which means that companies have to sit down and figure out what they really mean and what they're doing. And of course, the boards have to take a look at that. So the responsibilities at that level are creating new committees.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with clients now that have a human capital committee.
Wow.
Which is relatively new. But the tricky part with the United States is that we are much more about cowboy philosophy. We don't want to be told by regulation what's required.
Mm-hmm.
We like to do what we call principle-based, which is we'll figure out how we want to do it. You tell us we have to, we'll figure out the definition. So when you look at a requirement for a regulatory submission, there's no definition as to the terms. So the boards are all now scratching their heads and saying, okay, what should we publish? Mm-hmm. And if you look at what people are doing now, it's all experimental. Some people are putting data in related to compensation. Others are putting it in about D&I. Other people are putting it in about work corporate cultures and brand identification of ambassadorship with employees. So everybody's trying to figure out what they want to report and why. And that's not a bad thing.
That's very interesting.
It's really interesting. And you know, directors have to sit around the table and say, okay, what do we stand for and what do we want to publish?
Wow. And I love the historical context that you gave behind all of that. So thank you. That's very enlightening to myself. And I know our audience is going to walk away with some interesting facts on that as well. So we are living in, things are rapidly changing, including the involvement of what is the corporate structure. You see stories, just open one publication any single morning, and you can read about the latest unicorn that has made itself out there and is now valued at billions of dollars in a record amount of time. How do you think that you've had to evolve your strategy to meet this demand that's really lended to this culture that we're in of such a startup nature?
Well, with startups, one thing we know is that the earlier that they bring a board around the table,
mm-hmm.
a set of good talent around the table, the faster they grow.
Wow.
We're studying that correlation. So the earlier you bring the intelligence around the table, the acceleration rate of the business goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you convince somebody that's doing all the rock and roll of an early stage company to do that sooner is better? Sometimes that's a trick. But mm-hmm. that early stage is where we do quite a bit of work now, where there are investor groups that would like to have that done early because they're putting money on the table. And so that's a good thing to do. Now, if you want to talk about the Ubers and people that delayed going public as long as possible, what's been happening is that there are more creative ways to create access to income or money or investment dollars so that you could stall it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the question really is, if you're looking at a business like that, are they doing that because they just want to avoid the regulatory environment and the duties of care that go with it? Or do they have a meaningful strategy to just hold it in place for other business reasons? Mm. And so you have to figure out what their root orientation is and then work with them as best you can and make sense of that.
Right.
I'm on a board right now, and the CEO has been hammering since the first year I was on, we got to take this public. And I said, why so soon? Why wouldn't you wait and let the valuation grow? And he said, I want the discipline. I can't stand these unicorns. I want discipline. And their business is in New York, and it's right around the corner from the stock exchange. And he said, don't laugh, but I take the team over for a little tour of the place because I want them to know what it's going to feel like when we go public.
Wow. And
we have pretend calls, quarterly calls. And I said, I'm not laughing. I think that's darling.
Yes.
But that's ambition with structure and discipline as the cultural set. So you really have to know what you're dealing with.
Wow. What about, you know, given your experience, when you're dealing with multiple investment groups that all have to make up what is the boardroom now? I recently read something that came out this morning where a human capital payroll, global payroll platform just received $150 million in Series B funding. And now these new people are coming in. And how do you deal with the differences? At the end of the day, everything is about the dollar, but we are different personalities going into that boardroom. How is that managed and mitigated, especially when there's the new guys in town with the big bucks that are suddenly setting up shop?
Yeah, it's a delicate balance, which is why they create independent directors to come in and balance the negotiation between the founders and the investors. Mm. I'm the independent director for the company that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And it's four investors and two founders, and then me in the middle brokering deals often.
Yes.
Which just happens. Now, the other thing that's important about this is when you're taking somebody in because of their investment, you do have a right to explore whether that's the right person from the investment fund to be on the board on the basis of their experience, not just the wallet. Mm. So what we recommend is that you take a look at the styles of problem solving that are at that table. You know, it's really popular today to be talking about diversity, and most mm-hmm. people mean gender diversity when they bring that up, when in fact, it's really, from my view, diversity of thought. Because if you bring different ways of solving problems around the table and you debate an issue, the quality of decision-making goes up.
Right.
We know that's also true when it comes to innovation. If you put different styles of problem solving around the table, you get better results. So if you take a look at who's on our board today and you find out that it's homogeneous, everybody thinks alike, you don't have a board, you have a party. Everybody mm-hmm. gets along, they're having a great time. Mm-hmm. But if they can bring in different orientations and perspectives to the same issue, then you get much more whole problem-solving outcomes.
Right.
Now, that does mean that you have to have skills to handle difference. And I know that we talk about diversity. Diversity, yeah, diversity is a fact. But inclusion is a competency. And if you get diversity and you don't know how to handle it, you have all kinds of fights.
Right.
But if you have that social skill of how to address inclusion in a mindful way, then you have amazing discussions with mm-hmm. terrific outcomes. So I would encourage anybody who's looking at board work, or, you know, if they're on a board already and they're having frustration, that they go back and look at what that contextual set of thinking is, because they might be missing somebody that belongs there in the future that would make a different outcome.
That's fascinating, especially mentioning that, you know, we're not all supposed to be thinking the same way. There is supposed to be a little bit of, I guess you could say, friction against one person's opinion or strategic outlook versus the next. And now I have to continue to hit onto this point, because you've mentioned it, DE&I. It's been the top of many different companies. It's been in boardrooms all across the country. We can talk about what's led them up to this point in the last year and a half. why it's so pivotal now more than ever. I'd love to get your thoughts on to that process. And how do you think, well, you've given us a little bit of a taste of that. How do you think that boardrooms and corporate governance is going to have to evolve to meet the demand of perhaps future generational impacts that hold D&E and I to a higher priority than past generations?
Yeah. Well, first of all, whole topic of D and I and E is global. It's not just the US.
Right.
It's been pushed for the last decade. It is a wonderful time to be looking at this issue because it is a global phenomenon and everyone's looking at it with good faith as to what does it really mean. Right. We do know through early persnickety studies and now larger ones that those companies that actually bring that into their formula outperform the ones that don't.
Mm.
Now, what's been happening as a result of that, I call it the long arc of accountability that's moving, that people are saying, all right, it does make a difference. We will master this. And the investors and the shareholders and the larger associations are pushing that as a mandate. So now you've got all of these regulatory pushes for shareholders pushing for human capital management, and diversity is one of the top issues. It went from like 2018, the number of shareholder votes for approvals on things around diversity issues was about 18.3%. And 2 years later, it went to 36.8% impact.
Goodness.
So these are pushes that are coming onto the companies, onto the boards to address. Now, what happens as a result of that is that now this ESGR reporting mandate says you have to show us what you're doing. That's where the scramble is that I mentioned earlier, that the boards have to sit there and say, what are we going to report and how are we going to report it? And why do we want that metric as opposed to another metric? Where that goes is up for creativity for the time being, because diversity is not diversity is not diversity. If you go to Taiwan, when they passed their laws, they were trying to figure out what they were going to do to meet the demands for diversity. And they decided that what they were going to do, because most of the companies on the stock exchange there are family owned and then went public, that they were going to describe diversity as age. So they put their children on the board and say, we've got young people, we've got old people. Well, that doesn't work. But that's, you know, the techniques of attempt, if you will, as opposed to real interest in what the results will be.
Right. Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, all of this is leading me then to my next question. I think top of mind concern for any person, particularly in the times that we're in right now, is talent and the war on talent and corporate governance is going to have to do to retain top talent in the years ahead. So do you have anything, any sort of insight that you would give for retention strategies and how that can really be established at the top?
Yeah, you know, less of it is the responsibility of the board. More of it is the management on this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, boards certainly care about brand relationships and brand reputation, and they will look at talent as an ambassador. The employees are an ambassador of the brand, so they worry about those concerns, which is why you start to see all this stuff going on around what the companies should or can do to protect their brand when an employee on social media is doing something that doesn't uphold the brand, right? That's one issue that's being handled at the board level as well as management. But when it comes to retention, I think this whole COVID situation has caused a whole new view.
It really has.
It really has changed our thinking about what we're doing with inviting people and hoping they stay. Mm-hmm. And what happened, I noticed in the last year as we're coming out of COVID, is that people have had time at home to reflect on what the meaning of work is for them. And they're second guessing whether the job they had should be the job they'll continue to have. So there's lots of rolling over that's going on. People are saying, well, I was doing this, but maybe I think I should explore something new. And so there's a loss of some talent because people are going adventuring. Mm-hmm. And the trick, I think, for businesses to look at is our philosophy to retain, to invest so that we can hold them longer. And of course, you've got all these new super hard issues to look at as to whether we're actually building environments that are going to be just people as opposed to robots and new information ways to get things done. And there's a futurist who said a few months ago that the two most important people in the businesses today will be the head of HR and the head of technology, because you have to get a determination as to how much are you trying to recruit minds as opposed to people? Because if you have remote operations, you are not connecting in the same social dynamic that we used to have every day. And so if you're connecting minds to get work done over technology systems, they better work. And then understanding how you're going to keep people connected when it's not the social compelling value that we used to have that got us up in the morning to go to work.
Wow.
I mean, we know from psychology that when people get up and they go to work, unconsciously, they're trying to prove to themselves answers to four doubts. Am I significant? Am I competent? Am I likable? Oh, actually, yes, four. And can I cope? And when you bring people together and you train managers to create work environments in which the answer to all of those is yes, 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 then you've got something to work with. If you're all on a computer, how do you do that? And so the futurists are saying you have to think about what we really want out of this model going forward, because we sent everybody home and there's a lot of discussion about hybrids and things so that we can keep some connectivity and some flexibility. But it's going to be a really interesting challenge, and it's hard to know where that is. I mean, the challenge of managers and board directors today is to be a little bit more like, you know, a futurist, a Yoda. I tell people to go watch sci-fi. And really, I mean, because the world has already been invented in this imaginary world and it's coming, and we need to know what to do with it.
Well, and that's a perfect segue, because I know you're hitting on many different points that I think is going to be alluded on into the answer of what I prepared for the next question. But the only thing that is absolutely certain that we know is that the pandemic has truly pressed the fast forward button into what many were projecting would be the future of work. It's now here. I mean, we are now living it, and we are thinking what was going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years is actually going to transpire in the next 2 to 3. Whether you think about it from a global level to the type of worker that's engaged to how we have this work fulfilled, what is, in your opinion, because we can get into the weeds of that, but really, truly, what is at the core, in your opinion, of what the future of work looks like for you?
It's going to be an unusual mix of things that normally were done manually to now things that are automated, which means that the nature of the work that you still need your human psyche and your group dynamics to be in play, there'll be a shift in terms of orientation to that, and the skill set required for that will be more emphasized. Diplomacy skills, integrated thinking, those sorts of things will, if you have your three-year-old daughter coming up through school, you can coach her on that opportunity as opposed to becoming someone who's doing a data analytics or coding.
Right.
And knowing which one of those paths is going to be very different for opportunities going forward. If you like sitting behind a computer and you're doing stuff and you're not caught up in all the cultural things, that's one path. The other will be, I'm really good with people and I want to do this and build the culture that's going to make it possible.
Interesting. Interesting. I feel like I'm the latter. I can't be behind a screen all day, but that's just me. Well, and I think, you know, to summarize what you just said, at its very core is the technology that is really leading behind this. I mean, if you think about it, we're having this podcast recording on two different sides of the country. We're able to do so. The same comes true with work fulfillment, which is why we're seeing this new construct of workers called the digital nomad that's come up. It's almost 11 million workers in the country alone that are just, they could be working from the mountains in the Rocky one day, and then they're in Utah the next in the desert. I mean, you just never know. So all of that at its core is aligned to the technology that allows you to do that. And then some of the automation and perhaps robotic elements to figuring out what's you're going to be leaning towards this side or to that side.
It's so true. And, you know, I do think this experience of the last year and a half has given us more tolerance for what we normally would never have accepted.
Yes.
I was working with a couple of clients, and they were trying to write a work from home policy to let people occasionally be home every now and then. Mm-hmm. And then boom, they're all home whether they want to be or not.
Yes.
And we have mastered something here, which I think has created more possibilities for how we get things done. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's not. I always like to say in its most simplest form, I hope that the future of work will end and begin with the worker, which maybe could be, more convenient ways to fulfill work, to feel fulfilled in work, to be able to have the livable wages needed and to be able to go into a market where it's candidate driven and have the negotiations that, you know, live up to par to the cost of living. But that's just my opinion and my take on it. Mm-hmm. Now that we're wrapping up today's conversation, which makes me a little bit sad because I feel like I've gained so much knowledge from you in such a short amount of time. I'd love to hear what is your content diet? What are you reading up on that helps you stay abreast of all of these certain areas that you are, you know, the SME in? And then what would be that one book that you could recommend to the audience today?
Well, to be honest, in the last couple of years, I've been listening to more podcasts and, you know, TED Talks and things like that than actually sitting down and reading books. because it's easier sometimes to just listen for a while. Yeah. But there is one program that I very much enjoy that is a nonprofit called the Long Now Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they bring in futurists on various topics, and they present a view of the world on that special topic for about 45 minutes, and then they open it up for Q&A, and it's fascinating. And it's $8 a month to be a member of this, and it's the best education ever in the world. So I would encourage that to anybody.
As the Long Now Foundation.
The Long Now Foundation out of San Francisco. It's great. Now, when it comes to reading, because I'm very interested in problem solving and the way the mind works, I am interested in books like Factfulness, which Hans Rosling wrote, which takes a look at the biases by which we look at information and we make bad decisions because we've been set up with data that looks visually correct, but we're interpreting it wrongly.
Right.
And that book walks you through the ways to caution yourself from being caught in that trap.
Oh my gosh, it feels like that's nearly impossible to do sometimes.
Well, you got to know that it happens before you can know how to stop it. And that's why that book, and it's beautifully written. Another one is a book called Behave, which is the biology of humans at their best and worst, which is by a biologist talking about how our brains actually work. Mm-hmm. And I like that kind of material because everybody talks about the soft and the hard sciences in business. And what they mean is task-oriented stuff versus people. Hard being the task and people being the soft. And I don't understand why they don't call it hard and harder. Because the people is the complex part.
Every
day they walk in and you don't know what to expect. You just think you know somebody and oops, they're not like that today.
Nope.
So I'm very interested in understanding the psychology and the sociology issues that go with good cooperation or coordination of people. And how they think is really important to that. So I do study that. And then I'm a little bit more spiritual than maybe some other folks. So I like reading books like Alchemy by Paul Selig, because he asks you to step up into the upper room and look down on what really is going on in a bigger picture.
Wow.
And that's a little harder to read because you read two pages and then you have to go for a long walk to figure it out.
Like, what did I just digest?
But it's important to do that. You know, that you have a bigger view of what's really going on if you are nudged in that way. And that's helpful to me.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to see your story and how it's developed as somebody who was the thinker, the strategic, the blueprint, and then really figured out that at the core of everything is the human element. So I think that that shows, and certainly, you know, our audience has gotten some great recommendations on how you've gotten to that point based on some of the content that you digest. So as we're wrapping up today's podcast, how can we get a hold of you? Where's the best way to find Donna Hamlin?
Well, I think the easy way would be to go to our website, boardwise.biz.
Okay.
Or anybody's welcome to call me at 510-517-7791.
Boom. There you go. Awesome. Love it. Well, thank you to you so much for your time today. Thank you for our listeners as well. We hope that you really gained some insight in today's dialogue. And until then, we will see you guys in the next episode. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.